Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt. It's been a while.
I feel tanned and rested. it's like we've rekindled this relationship. There was, you know, I have to say, I don't know how people got by last week without us. And it's actually been, in a way, almost 2 weeks, you know, because we're taping late this week. There were some some gnashing of teeth on Twitter, but mostly I think people pulled through with us gone.
That's true, but it is nice to hear people pinging us saying, "Hey, where are you guys?" You know, yeah. It's nice to know people are thinking about us.
We did take to the Twitter feed at DMZ Show to alert super fans that we would not be taping last week, but I realized that not everyone follows us there at DMZ Show.
Now I have to say, Matt, we did it's a modicum of chit chat before we started taping. So it's not like we talked about this beforehand, but the tone of your voice then, the glow on your face today, I'm feeling like all of your lamentations about Donald Trump for the past year and a half, maybe two and a half years, that's all gone out the way. It's all good now, right? Nothing else matters.
The madometer today, I don't know if you how well you can see it, but it says Reaganing.
We're Reaganing.
And this has little to do, I think we do need to make an official chart. This has nothing to do with Donald Trump, but it's good news. I mean.
But does it make everything okay? Does nothing else matter? Does this make you say, you know what, I should have voted for the guy. I knew this was going to happen, it all makes it fine.
It's more like serendipity, but there's not, you know, like where the guy lucks into, Donald Trump could luck into being like a really important conservative president and doing some good stuff. And it's more like it's not the complete disaster that, you know, that I thought it might be. So
now, mind you, you say he's Reaganing.
And that was sort of a joke.
But let's remember, Reagan gave us Sandra Day O'Connor.
Yeah, and Kennedy.
Reagan gave us Anthony Kennedy, I mean, as well as Scalia. So these are two judges, O'Connor and Kennedy, that conservatives end up being really angry with because they upheld Roe v. Wade. The big assumption on both sides of the aisle is this is the end of Roe v. Wade, right?
I think that's... First of all, as you know, Bill, if Roe were overturned, that would just send it to the states, and some states would have abortion, some states would not. But I even think that is probably – there's probably too much angst or glee, depending on your perspective, about that possibility. My take is that the textualists, the originalists, they're not activists per se, and so
and then
you've got judges like Roberts, who probably, you know, give a lot of credence to stare decisis and precedent, who may not be. I could see Roberts becoming the new Kennedy and voting to kind of keep things from going. You know, we don't want things to get too radical. So I think that like the hype about that issue is probably a little bit overwrought.
Well, 2 points there. One, I want to talk about this more because I wrote about it. We just had the case of Janus versus AFSCME, where they explicitly rejected stare decisis in saying unions can't compel non-union workers to pay fair share fees, even though they're getting the benefits of any collective bargaining agreements. They explicitly said there was a ruling several decades ago. We think it was ruled incorrectly. Stare decisis is important, but it's not everything. If a kid is flatly ruled incorrectly, we have to overturn it. So
I think that's correct.
And Roberts is on that ruling. So we know Roberts is not some sort of stare decisis purist. There are times he will overturn. I do think what you're saying about a potential shift in role is plausible. Now, we can't get inside the guy's head. I don't think that the left should say, I'm not going to fight this nomination because it's all going to be okay in the end. We can't assume that. But there's something about group dynamics which I think, can get, make people shift their role.
Sure, absolutely. Psychological thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the conservative movement in general, and it's true on the left too, but I think more so on the right, the amount of vetting that goes into these judges is an attempt to prevent any kind of intellectual shifting over time. I mean, the whole point of the court, the entire structure of the court with lifetime appointments, is to insulate themselves from political pressure so they can think on their own and make decisions that aren't beholden to any kind of political faction, which is why, in many respects, Roberts upheld Obamacare. He did not have to answer to George W. Bush, the Republican Party, Mitch McConnell, whoever, making that decision. So we know Roberts is capable of doing that as well as overturning.
Yeah, but he's also but although Roberts was insulated from the pressure of the mob and the voters and the president, he has other pressures and other things lobbying him. And there's a sense like, number one, if you're an institutionalist, you may decide, well, we need to do the thing that's going to make the Supreme Court appear more august and strengthen them as an institution, regardless of whether or not it's the correct decision in terms of the Constitution.
Right.
There's also pressure maybe to be popular. You live in D.C. to be, applauded by liberal elites. So just because we have removed the pressure and the temptation for them to pander to the voters, they still exist in a world where there are other temptations. And I think conservatives have really lamented the fact that, by and large, liberals, Democratic presidents have a perfect track record of appointing people who essentially stay liberal, whereas Republicans have this problem where you get justices like Souter, for example, and we call them stealth nominees. I guess a stealth nominee would be someone that you don't even really know. They haven't talked about their politics. But you basically, there's this phenomenon where Republicans and conservatives have been burned so many times. And so now you do have groups like the Federalist Society that are not only vetting for your judicial philosophy, but also, I would say, vetting for temperament, vetting for your experience. I mean, everybody on the shortlist right now, all the people on the shortlist, for example, that Donald Trump is reportedly considering, clerked for the Supreme Court. So it's actually there's a certain credentialism involved. There's various factors. But certainly, yes, judicial philosophy, trying to find someone who will not move leftward once they're on the bench is a big part of it.
Yeah, and I don't think you're going to get any more Souters or Warrens anymore who totally surprise once they get there, because that level of vetting, the Federal Society apparatus, you know these folks, who they clerk for, they're scrubbed. So you're not going to have any wild shifts. But your other point about institutionalism and group dynamics. So
yeah.
Roberts, this is the Roberts Court. I mean, his legacy is bound in the entirety of the court. And if the court is, if its legitimacy is undermined, if it sparks an even deeper sense of political polarization in the land, that is fully on him. And with the loss of Kennedy, it is literally solely on him. It's not going to be Alito or Thomas or Gorsuch that saves the court's center. So we can't armchair psychoanalyze very easily, but just based on what has happened over the past several years, there is evidence that the backlash to Citizens United has affected Roberts and made him more careful in his decision making. So you see a lot of narrow rulings. I mean, he's still a conservative. He doesn't swing left a lot, but you're not seeing as many sweeping rulings that really totally overturn.
Well, like,
I mean, there's obviously an exception in the union case, but by and large, that's been the case. So he may say, if I don't put my foot on the brake, nobody else will, and I have to play that role.
Right. So I just had Ben Shapiro on my podcast yesterday, talking about this and who Trump should nominate and who Trump will nominate. And one of the points Shapiro made up or made, one of the points Shapiro made, which I did not know this, but he told me that if you read Kagan's commentary on the cake baker case, you know, if you have to bake a cake for a gay wedding, Roberts, and I don't know if Shapiro is reading between the lines here or what, but he told me that Roberts basically went to Kagan and said, like, we're going to get your vote, we're going to narrowly decide this. And so remember, this case did not set any precedent that might help us determine whether or not the state could compel a baker in the future. It really focused on whether or not the baker was sort of treated fairly and discriminated against based on his religion, but it doesn't give us any precedent going forward regarding whether or not a cake baker isn't actually an artist, different from a cook, let's say, or whether or not a baking for a gay person is different than having to bake for a religious or a ceremony, a wedding. And Roberts apparently did this in order so that it wouldn't be a 5-4 decision. He wanted to get Kagan on board, get her vote. And so instead of having a narrow vote, we ended up having a narrow decision.
Right.
And to me, assuming this is all true, and it sounds very plausible to me, assuming that's true, it really speaks to Roberts trying to be more of a peacemaker and have consensus rather than him trying to actually settle things, and for certainly settle things in favor of conservatives.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there's evidence of Roberts doing that sometimes. And there's other times, like in the gay marriage case, where Roberts, you know, teed off on Kennedy's opinion, basically said it was like wholly removed from the Constitution. So, I mean, I suspect Roberts is a very conflicted figure here, tugged at from both sides. I mean, he wrote, I think in the Reagan administration, that Roe v. Wade was wrongfully decided to be overturned. So we know what he believes or has believed deep down. But will he be tugged in that opposite direction when push comes to shove? I don't know if O'Connor and Kennedy knew what they were going to do on Roe v. Wade until really faced with it the Planned Parenthood Casey decision.
It's an interesting conundrum he faces, because on one hand, conservatives have been burned so many times by picking nominees who squish out on us once they get on the bench. We've elected politicians that we hope would change things only to see an activist liberal court overturn things or legislate from the bench. And so conservatives feel like, finally, we've got our people in there. Now we got to like roll back some of this stuff. And I totally appreciate and understand that impulse. There's the other side of the coin, which says, every institution in America today has declined in respectability. And like, if you are the Chief Justice, isn't it incumbent upon you? Isn't one of the major roles of that to protect, just like James Comey made this big mistake by trying to protect the FBI's reputation? I believe he thought he was doing that, or he was focused on that. There's going to be a temptation for Roberts, and I totally get it, to say, like, we need to protect. Number one, America's coming apart. We don't want to make decisions that are going to like roil the country, upset people, put people in the streets. So that's a temptation to basically moderate what you might otherwise do based on interpreting the Constitution. And also, we want to have the Supreme Court. Everything else, political parties are a joke, the Catholic Church is under attack. You know, the Supreme Court could be one institution that people still respect. How can we do that? And that, I'm not saying it's a bad goal, but it sometimes could be at odds with your actual job, the actual role of the Supreme Court. It's actually an interesting parallel, I would say, to what James Comey was trying to do with the FBI.
So the Washington Examiner, conservative publication, it has an editorial today saying overturn Roe v. Wade. Near the top, it says, in saving Roe v. Wade in 1992, Kennedy undermined the court's legitimacy and added extra poison to our politics. And the inference there is that if you overturn it, you're going to restore the court's legitimacy, and our politics will somehow become depoisoned, which just strikes me as just utterly ludicrous. I mean, take the court legitimacy question out of it, because maybe you think, look, this was just an intellectually mushy decision, and so if you write an intellectually tight decision that doesn't manufacture this right to privacy, then you will you'll be intellectually strong. I'm not saying I agree with that, but let's just put that aside. The notion that our politics is going to be calmed by the overturning of Roe v. Wade is insane in my mind.
Yeah.
But
I agree.
But I'm curious, do conservatives believe what the examiner is saying? Do they really think that if they overturn it, that it's all going to be tranquil after that? Or are they blinded or prepared for a ferocious backlash if that happens?
Well, all I can say is I've never heard anyone make the argument before that overturning Roe versus Wade would somehow bring about comity. And I certainly do think that there very well could be a backlash. You know, winning is losing and losing is winning sometimes. And, you know, so I've never heard that before. Look, I think even, and I wrote about this at the Daily Beast, my latest column, is even just the fact that we now have this fight over Kennedy, over, you know, replacing Kennedy, you know, it's just what the debate over civility needed, right? Is another fight. Now, look, I happen to think that, you know, this is by and large a positive thing, but we've got problems already, and this is one more thing to fight about, you know? It's a big deal. And Democrats, this is a real problem for Democrats, right? Because, look, we can go back to Obama filibustering Alito and Borking of Robert Bork.
I mean, Bork was actually blocked. I mean, that wasn't a filibuster. That was a majority vote. I mean, the Alito filibuster was a protest vote. I mean, there was no expectation he was actually going to get filibustered. He is court after all.
But there were norms that said that if a justice is qualified and experienced and there aren't extenuating circumstances like a huge scandal or something, that you would vote for him. But we can go back to Harry Reid going nuclear, blowing up the filibuster for most presidential appointments. You can do all that, and I do that in my column. But I also think in recent history, if you're a Democrat and you saw Merrick Garland, not only did Merrick Garland not get a hearing, but then you win the majority vote and still lose the presidency. And now the guy who got to be the president is going to get at least two Supreme Court justice picks. I can understand why Democrats would be. And if you throw in the fact that Trump is so unique, I could understand why Democrats would be apoplectic. Despite the fact that what's happening right now is actually pretty normal and routine, right? This is a Republican nominated justice who is retiring, and a president of the United States will be replacing him with, I believe, a highly respected and competent justice.
Well, I think what's interesting here, Kennedy himself was the byproduct of the Borking. Kennedy was known at the time as being relatively moderate, you know, compared to Bork and Douglas Kennedy, who got shot down after Bork. Republicans always knew, had a bit of concern that Kennedy was not going to be as reliable as Bork was, which proved to be true. I mean, Kennedy is largely conservative with some very notable exceptions. So Democrats who fought like hell to stop Bork and succeeded and got Reagan to pick someone who he would not have otherwise have picked. And that was after Reagan, you know, won a landslide election in 1984.
Yeah.
But this was in the second term, right? And this was after the Senate midterms, which went the Democrats' way. Now Democrats we have a minority president, you know, one of the minority of the popular vote, and is taking what had been a relative swing vote and is likely to make it a hardline conservative vote.
Right. Now, I mean, so I have to say, I hate to be, I always try not to come across as like a partisan hack. And I've written numerous times and I've said, you know, so many times about how Donald Trump concerns me greatly. I'm worried about the breaking of norms and the social fabric. And I think Donald Trump is a very, very bad person. I've said all of that. But when it comes to the Supreme Court specifically, you want to talk about norms being broken. What Democrats did to Robert Bork, I think the Clarence Thomas thing, at least if you're a conservative, that also sticks in the craw. But
though he was not, I mean, he had less than 60 votes of support, but was right. Not filibustered and is still on the court.
Yeah, he got like 52 votes, I think, yeah. Something like that. I'm just sort of, in a lot of cases, I think Donald Trump is the cause of our problems, or at least he really he took things that were problems and put them on like a level of 11, you know, like from Spinal Tap. But in the case of the Supreme Court, I hate to say you started it, but
do you want to go back to LBJ and Abe Fortas?
No, but let's just go to Harry Reid and going nuclear. I mean, I really believe that in this case, it was Democrats, by and large, who really broke the norms and the sort of, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? The forbearance, you know, the unofficial rules or the informal rules that kind of hold us together, that where you have people who were senatorial who would always vote for a nominee if they were qualified. And so I think that this is an example that really proves that Donald Trump didn't invent the current state that we're in, that he kind of just capitalized on it and has taken it to another level.
Well, you know, the Reid thing, let's remember, you know, look, Democrats obstructed some of Bush's judges. I mean, they did not play sweet with Bush's judges. But then Democrats had to stand down after the, it was a gang, I forget which number of gang it was. It was gang of Senator, gang of Air, gang of 14. But there was an agreement that basically said, okay, we're going to let the majority of these judges through. Some of them are very conservative. We're going to keep a few of them off, but you're basically going to stand down, not do as much filibuster.
This is like McCain and Lindsey Graham,
yeah.
You know, sort of brokering a deal to, right. Yeah.
So, you know, Bush had, at the end of the day, about 330 judges that got through, not just Supreme Court, but all the ranks, which was a bit less than Bill Clinton. I think Bill Clinton was 380. And look, in the day of Bill Clinton, give Republicans their due. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is there because of Orrin Hatch.
By the way, it go see the RBG movie, which is in that movie.
Right.
And you can see Hatch basically saying, and by the way, a much younger and I didn't realize good-looking guy
right. At one point. Because right, Clinton was having a hard time. He gave a feeler to Mario Cuomo and got shot down. He wanted Bruce Babb, yeah. The Interior Secretary, and the environmentalist said, "No, we don't want him to leave Interior. Don't do that." and Clinton was felt kind of stuck. And he goes to Orrin Hatch, who was Republican's judiciary point person, and said, "Who would you do?" And Hatch said, "In good faith, of all the people that you would actually pick, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because Ginsburg." was critical of Roe v. Wade, not the outcome. Like, she didn't say I would make abortion. She didn't say I would outlaw abortion. She said the way Roe was reasoned, I don't agree with. I would reason it a different way. She right. showed that kind of independent thinking.
No, it's a really good documentary. There's a scene where Hatch says, you know, we probably don't agree on anything politically, but you are an experienced and qualified justice. And so there's that scene in there. Have you seen it yet, Bill?
I've not seen it, but I do know that story. So anyway,
yeah, it's worth seeing.
So you get to the Bush years, you know, Democrats were obstructing, Republicans threatened the nuclear option at the time. You know, Bill Frist was ready to go, and it's the gang that stopped that. And then Republicans went on an obstruction tear for Obama, and the judicial process was really gummed up. And it's in the second term where Reid says, okay, this is ridiculous. We have to do this or else this is going to be inherently unfair. So at the end of the day,
Obama gets confirmed almost the exact same number of judges as George Bush did. People forget that. So there's a lot of
you mean
crowing.
even after going nuclear,
because you went nuclear. I mean, that wouldn't have happened unless you went nuclear. He needed to do that to keep pace. So the pendulum was swinging in a relatively even way. So Republicans now are saying, hi, Harry Reid, you know, thank you so much for going nuclear. You're screwed now. That is thinking of it in a very limited way, because what we have now is just a guarantee of wild judicial swings whenever one party has control. And so it's hard to say who is going to come out getting the long end of the stick, because the pendulum's going to keep swinging. We all know Republicans aren't going to be dominant in Washington forevermore.
Yeah.
You interviewed a guy
on your podcast, your new books podcast, Bill, that wants Democrats to pack the court.
Yes.
And I think that's I think it's a horrible thing for America, but why wouldn't they try? Well, you know, I mean, if this is the direction we're going, it's concerning to me, but it's not a crazy idea that if Elizabeth Warren were president and she had a Democrat Senate, that you give it a shot.
Well, look, packing the court in some respects is more legitimate than the nuclear option. The nuclear option requires exploiting a quirk in the Senate rules that you ignore the one rule that it requires, you know, two-thirds of a vote to change a Senate rule.
Mitch McConnell always said Harry Reid wants to break the Senate rules in order to change the Senate rules.
Right.
Neither of these things are written in stone. I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that says you have to have 9 justices, and there's nothing that says you should need 60 votes to confirm a Supreme Court justice.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, if we have the votes to change the law and put more people on the court.
But this is where what they talk about in Why Democracies Die is that in order to have a functioning democracy, you should exercise forbearance, which is to say, just because I can do something doesn't mean I will, because we should self-police and not run up the score on the other side, because someday they may be in power and they may do that to us.
Well, and if the Supreme Court becomes something that radically changes every time there is an election, it no longer is serving the function that was intended by the founders, an institution that is insulated from politics because they are lifetime appointees.
So where does it end, right? We go to 13 judges. Then we go to 20.
Well, if it went that way, it would go up and down with every election, and the rulings would change with every election, and there'd be no continuity anymore. There'd be no sense of this is what the Constitution says, period, and we all have to operate within that rubric.
It's scary. It is scary that I believe that there should be a constitutional amendment saying that there are going to be 9 justices. You know,
to get that, you would need both parties to agree in a very broad way. But keep in mind, I mean, some people look at FDR's court packing scheme. And I just saw an essay written about this on something called the Outline. I think it's a pretty common view on the left that, sure, FDR failed to actually pack the court, but in doing so, he put pressure on the court and made them change their ideological outlook.
I think that's true.
It's not true. It is not true.
All right. Well, I have to. Bill, you know, I did write my dissertation on this topic, but for those who are not as schooled as you and I will let you explain why.
Actually, it is in this book right here. FDR Into the Storm, Kenneth Davis. I can't remember the exact page. I can't flip to it and read from it directly, but basically the so-called switch in time that saved the 9, there is one judge, I believe his name was Roberts, that he shifted on this key point, whether or not, you know, New Deal type legislation would be allowed, because one of the big New Deal programs, the National Industrial Recovery Act, got struck down by the court in FDR's first term. FDR lamented, we're going back to the horse and buggy days. But he doesn't run on that subject in the first term. But then winning was such a landslide for a second term, he thinks, I am basically one with the people. I am an instrument of God. And if I do this, the people will be with me. And he doesn't know that that justice had changed his view in an opinion that he wrote that hadn't gone public yet before FDR makes his announcement. So it was already done. It just hadn't been published.
Ah, okay.
So the public thought the court packing scheme was what made the court switch, but it's not actually true. So in the Ferris book that he was on my podcast, he talks about how FDR had this grandiose scheme. Some of the Senate Democrats were trying to compromise with him and offering things that were half a loaf, and FDR wouldn't hear of it. And so his point was, hey, FDR could have taken half a loaf and it would have worked. But the point is the public was vehemently against it. It failed because the public was vehemently against it. It was unnecessary because the court switched anyway on its own intellectual merit.
Right.
And it contributed to FDR's terrible 1938 midterm because FDR was so angry about this and a few other things, they wanted to purge the conservatives from his party, and that backfired miserably. So even if Democrats do get in their heads that they want to try that again, I think there's a lot of historical evidence to say that's a bad idea.
I hope you're right. I worry that our politics has changed to the degree where everything is about mobilizing your base and not persuasion, and so the incentives are different now. But I hope you're right because the voters may be the last line of defense when it comes to preserving our norms and keeping this thing from going off the rails.
This actually leads into something that I wrote about this week about the Ocasio-Cortez upset of Joseph Crowley in New York 14. So she is a 28-year-old Democratic Socialist, you know, member of Democratic Socialists of America, beating a party boss type, someone who was assumed as possibly the next Speaker of the House if Pelosi stepped down or was ousted. But more of a mainstream Democrat, I know in the Democratic Socialist telling he's a corporatist and whatnot. And so because she won, this is being treated as this big bellwether that the socialists are taking over, the center of gravity of the party is shifting. And so more things like court packing type schemes and whatnot will be more likely because the Democrats are swinging so hard to the left. But the same night that she won, Antonio Delgado won a very crowded primary in New York 19, which is a swing district, which Republican John Faso beat Zephyr Teachout 2 years ago. He's a corporate attorney for Akin Gump, which is one of the biggest, you know, D.C. Lobbying firms, although I don't think technically he's a lobbyist, but he's part of that firm. I mean, he ran on a relatively liberal platform, but he stopped short of Democratic Socialist things like single payer. And there were people of that ilk in that race. In Maryland 6, was that your district, Maryland 6?
Yeah, that's where I'm from, yeah.
So Maryland 6, now represented by John Delaney, who is a millionaire Democrat, moderate Democrat, who's running for president, which you may or may not know, but he's actually announced his.
I had heard. I may be the only one.
Now, that primary is won by David Trone, who is a multimillionaire wine mogul, also relatively moderate, and he beat a single-payer advocate in that race. In Colorado's gubernatorial primary this past Tuesday, Jared Polis, who was opposed by the teachers unions because Polis is a charter school founder, he won handily in that race. So it's not like, I mean, look, Democratic Socialist, the fact that she won is not meaningless. It is very clear that post-Bernie, there is a energized Democratic Socialist faction that are winning certain races across the country. Cortez is not alone. There are other races that DSA people can point to. So you're going to have a more vocal and aggressive socialist faction in the Democratic Party. That is true. But there are plenty of other races where socialists are not faring well, that more moderate Democrats are doing well. Connor Lamb, Doug Jones. It's not like these people don't win races too. So you're more
yeah, but,
like...
but Well, I would say, one, you're right. Look, so first of all, I think that the Cortez story gets the perception is that this is a huge trend, probably because of the newsworthiness of the socialist winning. She's young, she's a female, and it's New York. I mean, I think New York always gets more publicity. If the same thing had played out somewhere else, it probably doesn't get as much attention. But having said that, it is interesting that there, even though it's not indicative of the entire party, the fact that this is happening, that socialists are winning, is a big deal. And I think, to me, it's a sign of the Europeanization of our politics, where we've got nationalists like Trump, and now we have Cortez. So the perception, though, is that this is like, a game changer across the board. Definitely noteworthy, but I think you're right. It's not
I mean, this is a
the
district
only.
that has a D plus 29 district, which is the 29 points above the national average in Democratic leaning. Clinton won the district by over 50 points. This is not New York 19, which is Republican hell. This is not Maryland 6, which is Democratic leaning, but much less so, and has plenty of rural areas. This is not this is not Alabama where Doug Jones won, or Western Pennsylvania where Conor Lamb won. So it doesn't mean that Ocasio-Cortez's win, it has no import, but it's, I mean, and she's almost certain to win the general, by the way. And look, you had Kara Eastman win in Nebraska too, which is Omaha and Omaha suburbs. But we don't know if Kara Eastman can win Nebraska too in a general. We know she can win in a primary. There are many people winning races in Democratic primaries who are Democratic establishment. There are several people winning who are economic populist slash democratic socialist. And there's a third group, which are these outsider military veterans who aren't cleanly in ideological camp. Seth Moulton is a factor in this. He's the congressman from Massachusetts, young congressman, under 40, military veteran himself. He has this Serve America PAC, which is backing many veteran candidates, and he said he's going to expand beyond strict veterans to other service-driven people, like people who are AmeriCorps veterans, for example. But his criteria is service-driven. It's not ideological. So Gina Ortiz in Texas 23, she was to the left of Jay Hullings, who was a Blue Dog PAC-backed Democrat. She's a veteran. She beats Hullings. Whereas Rachel Reddick, who is a former Republican, she loses in Pennsylvania 1 to very progressive Scott Wallace, who's the grandson of FDR Vice President Henry Wallace. So the veterans who are winning these primaries are not from a clear ideological background, but they're also somewhat anti-establishment. I mean, Moulton had famously opposed Nancy Pelosi for running for Speaker again. His interest is having a class of young, fresh blood, which is not tied to the establishment. So all these factions are winning primaries right now. We don't know what kind of Democrat is going to do best in swing areas. And maybe they all win some races. Maybe it's not fully adjudicated by November. But Ocasio-Cortez has nothing to do with that debate because she is in one of the deepest blue districts in the country. Her import is that districts that are left are swinging harder left. And to some extent, that pulls the center of the gravity of the party left, but it doesn't make the entire party socialist. So you're going to have debates over abolishing ICE. You're going to have debates over single payer. You're going to have debates over tactics like impeachment and court packing. There's nowhere. So does this
But
mean
I
the
think
Democratic Party is a,
along.
just one thing to wrap up. So does this mean the Democratic Party is a bigger tent that all gets along, or is it going to be Europeanized and fracture at its core? And where in Europe you have green parties and whatnot, that is a big unknown.
Yeah, as I was saying, I think that for most of my life and your life, the parties have been playing sort of between the 40-yard lines, Yeah, you had conservative Republicans. Yes, you had liberal Democrats, but you didn't have quite the extremes that we're seeing now, where you're seeing kind of the nationalists on the right and the socialists on the left. So I think the spectrum is expanding in American politics on both sides.
So something else that I wrote about this week, and let me just say, I had my first Politico twofer. I had two articles published in Politico on the same day.
That's is that a record? I mean, for a columnist,
right? I mean, you might have news items that are shorter that you might get more than byline a day, but these are full blown, you know, long form analytical pieces. So I think a twofer should be lauded, which no one read either because as soon as they were both up, Kennedy retires and screws up the whole thing.
What do you think is going to happen between the time we tape this dialogue and the time that it publishes, Bill?
Probably Thomas is going to retire.
Only if my lobbying pays off.
So as I mentioned earlier in the show, the last 5-4 decision from the court this term was on unions, Janus versus AFSCME, which ruled that it violates First Amendment grounds to say to a non-unionized worker in a public sector job that you have to pay a fair share fee to the public sector union because the collective bargaining agreements the union negotiates applies to you. So you have to chip in. You can't be a free rider and benefit from the agreement without chipping in something. The court said you're coercing those workers to subsidize speech that they don't necessarily agree with, so that can't happen anymore. This is a devastating blow to the union movement. The union movement is premised on worker solidarity. You're negotiating for the entire workforce. You have the strength of the entire workforce. There's incentive not to be free riders, so most folks will put in the union dues. Now, the worker has the incentive to say, what? The agreement's going to apply to me anyway? Who needs to pay the union dues? I'm gonna pocket that money and go home. But if the union then has fewer members, they have less pressure to bear on management. They can't easily threaten a walkout or a slowdown or a one-day stoppage or what have you. So the labor movement's been terrified of this decision for months.
I'm wondering, Bill, the correlation between the decline of union membership, which was probably going to happen anyway, but it's certainly expedited by right-to-work legislation and conservative activism. So I'm wondering about the correlation between the decline of unions and the rise of identity politics. Because the unions, for most of our lives, were the ground troops for the Democrats. I mean, they were the base of the Democratic Party, and they were the people who worked the elections, like not only voting, but actually manning the polls, turning out, like having a machine to drive people to the polls and turn them out. I'm wondering if the rise of identity politics focusing on how do we get this block of women, this block of Hispanics, is that a sort of a desperation move, an inexorable result of the decline of unions?
I think it's more complicated than that because, you know, you look at the labor movement and Democrats, you know, pre-McGovern, pre-Reagan, there's a lot of tension there between the labor activists and the civil rights activists and other, you know, anti-war activists. You know, these are people who are not fully on the same page. And, you know, one of the big struggles the left had in the 60s was trying to get unions to be in solidarity with them on civil rights and on the war when unions are more singularly focused, you know, good wages for my members. And there's been a lot of racism within unions. It'd be my heart for an African American or a Latino to get into the union and have access to those good paying union jobs. I mean, George Wallace was essentially a candidate for that white working class unionist that didn't care for the social liberalism that the Democratic Party was drifting towards. Now, you then have a decline of unionism that begins around the Reagan era, and some tie that to the air traffic controllers strike. I don't necessarily know if that's really true. There's certainly a correlation, but not necessarily a causation, in my opinion. But nevertheless, you know, it used to be that the workforce was about 30% unionized in the early 80s, and it's now about 10% unionized. Private sector unionization is 6.7%. So it's public sector unionism that has propped up the union movement in recent years. So to get back to your identity politics question, as unions have tried to beef up their ranks, they have started to reach out more to non-white workers. You know, SEIU's Justice for Janitors campaign was in large part to get not just a class of workers who aren't unionized, but largely a class of Latino workers that weren't unionized. So the union movement is much more racially diverse than it has been. But at the same time, there are your classic white working class union members who are still drifting away from the Democratic Party.
And they're probably, they're probably Trump. A lot of them are probably Trump voters now. Yeah. If they, you know, the ones that exist, the remaining, because the numbers are dwindling, but the remaining working class white union guy is probably maybe a Trump voter now.
I mean, Obama got about 58% of union households, if I remember correctly, and Clinton got about 51%. And this is even though unions still give a lot of money to Democrats, they put a lot of ground troops on the floor, but there's a disconnect between the union leadership and some of the union rank and file. And so there was a drop there, which is not healthy for Democrats.
Well, but I wonder about the health for America. Like, so as a conservative, the idea of someone compelling me to pay them money for something I don't want to do, whether I want it or not, whether that just philosophically bothers me. And I know that Republicans hated unions because they were the ground troops to elect Democrats. But having said that, I wonder if we might be better off, if Republicans might be better off, if conservatives might be better off, if the Democratic Party still had a big cohort of these, you know, blue-collar guys in there keeping them from going farther left.
Well, it's a little moot to say because it's not going to happen. I mean, Janus came down.
But we helped, and when I say we, I mean Republicans, conservatives, helped destroy unions. Like, they were a target of the conservative project and right-to-work legislation, which philosophically I support, helped to, at the very least, helped to hasten their demise. And I just wonder if there may be long-term unintended consequences.
Well, part of that goal is to get those white working-class voters to be Republican, a project that has also worked. I mean, white working-class voters were leaning strongly Republican before Trump. It just got supercharged with Trump. So now...
But now you have parties... I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
But just to get back to the point of the piece that I wrote, so Democrats have to realize that unions are flatlining. And I don't say this with glee. I think it's just you got to accept the reality here that the one tentpole remaining in the union movement was public sector unions. Now they just got a death blow. And that doesn't mean that Democrats should say bad things about unions, because they still need those people to vote for them and to give money to them and to knock on doors for them, even though there might be less of them. You don't want to lose what you do have. But at the same time, there's a lot of progressive thought, which is the way to reduce the economic inequality and the wealth gap in this country is by a union renaissance. And there's a lot of good evidence for that. You can look at Europe. You can look at Canada, where the union rates are higher and the wealth gap is smaller. But it's just not going to happen now. I mean, even in your wildest dreams, I mean, the thing that Democrats want the most is to keep management out of the decision making whether to unionize. So right now, if a union has a petition that says, I got a majority of the workforce that we want a union, management can say, well, we're going to have an election to make sure that's really true. And then you have to have a union election. In the Obama years, they had a bill called the Employee Free Choice Act, which says that decision is not management's. It's the union decision to make whether they organize via petition or something called card check or having an election. Management is wholly removed from the equation. When that was proposed, several moderate Democrats balked, even though they had 60 in the Senate. They couldn't have it. They didn't have a unified 60, and the bill never got sent to the floor. Now Bernie Sanders and several other Democrats running for president are backing the Workplace Democracy Act, which is Employee Free Choice Act supercharged. It has that provision and several others to ease unionization. So number one, even if Democrats take back the Congress, even if Democrats control the White House, you can't guarantee you're going to get a hard 60 for that legislation. It's not just because there are obnoxious corporatist moderate Democrats in the world. In British Columbia, Canada, which was run by the Liberals for a long time, you have a split between the Liberals and the New Democrat Party. New Democrat Party is a unionist party. They want card check. The Liberals generally haven't. So Liberals were in charge for a long time. They didn't do card. They actually took away a card check that was there. NDP got back in power, but in coalition with the Greens. The Greens won't let the NDP do card check because it violates the principle of a secret ballot. So there's always somebody that seems to get in the way of that. So you just can't know what's going to happen. Even if it does happen, even if it's the Cortez Revolution and the Democratic Socialists fully take over the party and that's the top priority, you're going to be at below 6% unionization by the time this happens. The time it's going to take to get back to a 30% is going to be decades in your wildest dreams. And
you're by then, robots will be doing all the work anyway.
Right, Democrats will have to deliver for the working class on a much shorter time frame if they're going to keep power. So that means it's incumbent on Democrats to come up with a policy platform that is not contingent on unionization. And they have ideas. I mean, they have, you know, universal, expanding healthcare with single payer or otherwise, minimum wage, universal preschool, college affordability. There's ideas about guaranteed jobs or guaranteed income. I'm not saying I endorse any one of these things. Also, there's the whole pension system question. How do we strengthen private pensions as well as Social Security? You're going to have to put your thought into those questions. And the gig economy, you always have been a free market man when it comes to Uber and Lyft and whatnot. How do those should those workers be independent contractors, or should they have some worker protections because they're so hard to unionize? These are the kind of questions Democrats have to grapple with because the unions are not going to be the saving grace here.
I like it, man. Wow, this is what happens when we bottle up 2 weeks where we don't talk.
We've gone on for a long time. Anything else you need to yabber about before we go?
I just need to shamelessly self-promote stuff.
All right, what do you got?
Great podcast week this week, Bill. I had John Berman on, the new anchor of CNN's New Day, talking about journalism. And he started off working as a senior writer for, I think it was Peter Jennings. Is it Peter Jennings? Was that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Peter Jennings. And just a great guy and a great conversation about journalism. And then I had Ben Shapiro on, as I said, and we talked about the Supreme Court, also the two different types of never Trumpers. And then I have coming out, Mark Ambender has a new book out called The Brink. And it's about the 1983 nuclear scare. And it hasn't published yet. I haven't put this up, but Ambender is has become, in writing this book, a big Reagan fan.
Wow.
Yeah. And we talk a lot about that in the second half of the conversation. So stay tuned. You can go to we're on iTunes and Stitcher. It's called Matt Lewis and the News. So this week, John Berman, Ben Shapiro, and Mark Ambender talking about his new book. Check it out.
Very exciting. And yeah. Check out my piece of Politico this week. I think my podcast with Michael Cohen, not that Michael Cohen, author of American Maelstrom about the 1968 election, which is out in paperback now. I had him on New Books in Politics. Fascinating insights about Robert Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, George Wallace, Reagan, Nixon.
Will you send me his contact info?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I'm sure.
We actually do business here, people. This is not just for your entertainment.
So check that out. New Books and Politics at the newbooksnetwork.com. And hopefully we'll talk next week on the 4th of July here, if not on the 4th, whereabouts.
That's right, my man. All right. Great. Great talking. And thank you all for watching and listening. And we'll be back in the DMZ next week.
All right. Take care.